I have titled this talk, Endure the Tree, or as it reads in Hebrews, and Endure the Cross, but I believe that it was a tree or a stake, not a cross, but I'll get into that later. It's my intention today to relay to you the in-depth chronicles of Christ's final hour. I will be describing the characteristics of the crucifixion process and the events leading up to it using biological details to explain why Christ died so quickly. I will begin at the Garden of Gethsemane and finish at the piercing of Christ's side. I mention that he died quickly because the stake was a form of torture, basically. It was meant to be prolonged. People would hang on these things for a period of a few days to longer than that, and it is important what happened to him beforehand to explain why he died so quickly. So, just getting into this. We find Christ in Gethsemane praying to his Father, and I'm going to read from Luke 22. Starting at verse 42, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. I think it is very important to note that even through this trial, Christ is still bending his knee to his Father, saying, not my will, but thine be done, because it clearly was not his will that he be killed. Even up to the time right before he died, he continued to deny himself. The sweat, as it were, great drops of blood is what we are most interested in here, though. I believe Luke was a physician, and that is something he would have been interested in as well and noted that it happened. This sweat coming out in blood, it's a condition called hematohydrosis, hemat meaning blood and hydrosis meaning water. And the reason this occurs is because around the sweat glands there are multiple blood vessels and they form a net-like form. Under the pressure of great stress, the vessels constrict. This is called vasoconstriction. Now, this occurs because part of our nervous system, it's called the sympathetic nervous system, is activated. This constricts cutaneous blood vessels, other blood vessels, and directs it to more needed areas like the muscles, the heart, and the brain. And under great stress, under the time period he was under great stress, which was quite a while, they would have been constricted near to the point of being completely closed for a long time. And it says, then as the anxiety passes, the blood vessels dilate to the point of rupture. The blood goes into the sweat glands. As the sweat glands are producing lots of sweat, it pushes the blood to the surface, coming out as droplets of blood mixed with sweat. Though this appears to be a small detail about Christ's mental suffering, it is in fact a physical representation of Christ's acceptance of the final trial placed before him. We know from the passage that Christ was under great mental stress and that he did not want to be killed, but it was not possible for him to be sacrificed unwillingly and it still be an effective sacrifice. It was required that he submit to his Father's will, as we read in Isaiah 53, verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. He remained silent, not defending himself or fighting the will of his Father at all, which the remain silent I'll get into a little bit later. As he became compliant to this last task, an angel was sent to comfort him, and he was finally in the right frame of mind to fulfill his role as the Christ. This comfort and acceptance relaxed his mind and body, and that is when the cutaneous blood vessels dilated and ruptured, spilling the blood into his sweat. The only thing I can think to compare this to is if you're sitting down or standing up with your knees locked for a long period of time, and then you move, if you're sitting down for a long period of time and then you stand up, your knees get really stiff and it hurts to stand up. That's kind of the same thing that happens with these blood vessels. After being constricted for such a long period of time, once they dilate, they're just not used to that. So they dilate completely in rupture, and that's when the blood goes into the sweat glands, and that's when it comes out. And the only time that this happens is when a person relaxes, when they decide that this is not something I need to be stressed over, or the stress just passes. So as we see beforehand, Christ was under great stress, did not want to be killed, knew that he had to go through with this sacrifice. But as he realized that it was something he could do, he did set his mind to it, the stress kind of passed, the stress did pass, and that is when the blood vessels dilated. I think that this is an important event here, showing that he decided to set his mind to this, to the crucifixion, to his death. The next part of Christ's journey was seizure by the Jewish soldiers and condemnation by the priests. Jesus was set before a council of priests, scribes, and elders to judge him according to the accounts given by false witnesses. This is in Mark chapter 14. Starting at verse 53, and they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And Peter followed him afar off, even under the palace of the high priest. And he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. And the chief priests and all of the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bare false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bare false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." But neither so did their witness agree together. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" But he held his peace and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him and said unto him, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest rent his clothes, and saith, "What need we any further witnesses? Ye have heard the blasphemy, what think ye?" And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And some began to spit on him, and cover his face, and to buffet him, to say unto him, "Prophesy." And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. Under Jewish laws, a man could not be convicted if there were two or more witnesses that agreed on one offense. And as we know, Christ was very, very familiar with the law. Many men paraded their false testimonies before the council, but none of them agreed on one accusation, so the priest could not condemn him. Finally, one man twisted Christ's words, and the priest sought a rebuttal from Jesus, but even at the accusations, he did not answer. That is tied into the Isaiah reference I read earlier. Even at any response they sought from him to defend what people accused him of, he never answered. But it was not until he admitted that he was the Christ that they condemned him. Whenever somebody asked him, "Are you the Christ?" or I think Pilate asked him, "Art thou the King of the Jews?" he said, "Thou sayest it." He never responded to any accusation that was put to him. They began to spit on him, and after blindfolding him, they hit him and mocked him, asking, "Who smote thee?" But still he remained silent, as Isaiah said he would, even though he had the power to speak the name of each person who hit him. This is a great show of self-control to me, because we know that numerous times he would stand around speaking and know the minds of his apostles or know the minds of the Pharisees, and he would be upset with them for thinking a certain way or being angry at him, and he would confront them on this, saying, "Why do you have such little faith?" I can't remember exactly how he puts it, but numerous times he knows what they are thinking, and he brings it to them. But even now, when he's blindfolded, knowing, having the power to know the people who are striking him, he still says nothing. Moving on, though, the next part of Christ's physical trial was the scourging he endured. And this is where I'm going to use one of these. This is a representation of a scourge that a guy made. I don't think that it looked exactly like this, but it's the best that I could find. We know that they had bone and nails in them, and that's what's at the end here. Some of these, I don't know how many of you have seen a scourge, but now you have, but these are very deadly torture devices. The scourge had many leather strands coming from it, and at the end of the strand was usually a piece of bone, glass, or a nail to increase tissue damage and pain. Not everybody who would be crucified were scourged first, but many of the people who were scourged died before they made it to their crucifixion because of the blood loss that was sustained. They were not just whipped on the back, they were whipped everywhere. And these things would go deep and tear arteries, and the blood loss was too much for their bodies to handle. They could not clot fast enough to stop it. With each strike of the scourge, skin would be ripped, torn, and gashed. The blood loss sustained when scourged was massive. To compensate for blood loss, the heart beats faster. Simultaneously, the vessels around the site of injury, which after a scourging would be almost everywhere, would constrict, which in turn raises blood pressure. This rise in blood pressure plays a crucial role in Christ's crucifixion later. Now, when your body and the tissue in your body needs a certain amount of nutrition all the time. If you lose blood, your heart beats faster in order to increase the circulation so that all the tissue can still receive the same amount of nutrition that it did when there was less blood. That is why the heart beats faster. Where was I? Though clotting would have begun immediately, there was already great blood loss, and it would have taken several minutes for the clotting to be complete, assuming that Christ remained in one position. But when walking, standing, sitting, bending, the wounds would constantly be cracking and reopening, causing more bleeding. This would have happened even more as he struggled to carry his stake. Though only mentioned briefly, the damage done by the scourging was profound. I believe this is part of what Isaiah was writing about in Isaiah 52, verse 14. Says, as many were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. With the release of Barabbas as the final committal to Christ's crucifixion by the Jews, Christ was taken by the Roman soldiers to be mocked and beaten further. This is in Matthew 27. Starting at verse 27. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers. And they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! And they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. This horrible humiliation was accompanied by more pain and bleeding as the crown of thorns was plaited, or as it is defined in Strong's, twined or braided and placed on his head. Since there is no record of them removing it, it probably remained on his head for all to see until Joseph of Arimathea removed it while preparing his body for burial. This crown contributed to Christ's blood loss also. As any of you know who have hit your head hard enough for it to start to bleed, it takes quite a while to get a head wound to stop bleeding. The reason for this is attributed to all the hair that most of us grow on top of our head. There's a large capillary bed outside the skull which provides nourishment to our skin and hair follicles. This initial adorning of the thorny crown would not only have started the bleeding, but would have caused tremendous pain. As the soldiers bowed down, mocking him, the wounds would have had time to begin clotting, but would not have had time to stop the bleeding. Before it could clot completely, the soldiers took the reed and hit him on the head, reopening, creating new wounds. I believe this also contributed to Isaiah's prophecy that I read a little while ago being fulfilled. I don't know if you can imagine this. I know that a lot of us have scraped our head and had stuff and, scratch our heads and stuff, and it hurts a lot to be hit in the head. But imagine thorns everywhere in your scalp, just being shoved down on your head once and not being removed, not having the power to take it off. But then after that, somebody taking a reed and just pounding your head repeatedly, driving these things in further and further, not to mention the pain that would be caused just by the reed alone hitting your head. It's hard for me to think about. Christ faced great humiliation throughout all of this. What followed was probably the most demeaning part of all, though. I don't know how far the march was to Golgotha, but whether it was 100 feet or a mile, in Christ's physical condition, it was impossible for him to carry his stake. This would have been very demeaning to any of us. Now, Jesus was typically a strong, healthy man. Jesus, typically a strong, healthy man, could not bear this himself. We all know that he was a carpenter. Now, you do not work in carpentry and remain a scrawny, weak person. Now, while Christ was not a bodybuilder, the stake he carried would not have put up so great a resistance that he would not have been able to carry it himself, most likely, if he had been his normal self, but we know he was not. He had not eaten or drank anything for around 15 hours. He was bleeding still and had already lost a significant amount of blood, and this all contributed to great fatigue, which caused him to continually stumble, and that's why they had to pull Simon, to help him carry his cross, or to carry the stake, excuse me. But finally he made it to Golgotha. The tree was laid down on the ground, and Jesus was placed on top of it, lying down. His hands were stretched out above his head, one placed on top of the other, and the crucifixion nail driven through his palms. The crucifixion nail was about 14 inches long, coming to a fairly sharp point at one end with a circumference comparable to that of a railroad spike. Now, I wanted everybody to be able to visualize this. This is a railroad spike that I was able to find. The crucifixion nail was about twice as long as this, and it was just a little bit skinnier than this. But imagine this being driven through your hand, through both hands and feet. It's painful, I'm sure. I've already read that part. A crucifixion nail would have been about twice as long and slightly smaller in circumference, as I told you already. As the nail was driven through his hands, it would have broken the arteries of the palmar arch and caused excessive bleeding, not to mention the excruciating pain. Now, the palmar arch in your hand goes around like this. It comes from one side and goes up and around and goes down the other, and they supply blood to the fingers. And it's not a very big artery, but a lot of blood still flows through it. The nail would have passed between the second and third metacarpals, which I'm about to show you, missing all the bones, which we know is important because it said a bone of him was not broken. These bones here are the metacarpals, and the right between here is where the nail would have passed. After this, his feet were placed on the stake. His knees were bent, so his feet were flat against the tree, placed one on top of the other, and a nail was driven between the second and third metatarsals of the feet. These here are the metatarsals. You can't see the rest of them. The nail would have been driven between there. As it was driven through, it would have broken the medial plantar and the dorsalis pedis arteries, also causing much bleeding. These also supply the feet. They kind of form a web between the bones, and they supply just like the palmar arch does to the hand. They supply blood to the toes and the rest of the feet, and quite a bit of blood goes through these arteries. The arteries which were damaged in the hands and feet of Jesus are ultimately what led to his death. As I said earlier, the blood pressure was raised as the veins or the vessels around the damaged area from the scourging were constricted, These are the arteries here, and the arteries in their feet are some of the arteries that would have needed extra blood as he was going through this. The arteries running through his muscles and his legs, his chest and his brain, and his arms also. As he hung there, more blood would have come out through his feet. As the heart beat faster and faster, it did not. It contributed more to the release of blood from his body as he bled from his feet, and this is why he bled out so quickly. After he was nailed down, the soldiers lifted his stake off the ground, carried it over to a hole, and dropped it in, jerking the crucified Christ violently and causing further tissue damage and bleeding, mainly in the hands and feet. It is important to note that despite how thin our hands are, the cartilage within them is very tough, and when placed on top of each other, they can hold a great deal of weight. With the center of gravity pointing straight down on this stake, there was no fear of tearing the cartilage and falling off the stake when dropped into the hole. This is not so with the cross. This here is why I believe that it was not a cross that he was crucified on. With the Roman cross, the center of gravity changes and pulls at an angle. I'm gonna put this up here so everybody can see it a little better. With the stake, you're crucified like this. And the center of gravity is straight down, pulling on your hands and feet in both directions, straight down. On a cross, when you're crucified, your hands are out to the side, and the center of gravity changes, pulling in an angular direction, so that more weight is placed on each hand out to the side, pulling in. There would not have been, your hands are not strong enough to hold that much weight by themselves. And most likely, they would have torn and the victim would fall from the cross. But if on the cross, the victim were crucified through the wrists, were nailed through the wrists, there would have, there's a better chance that they would have held up. They would have been able to hold up. But also going along with piercing through the wrists, as I showed you on here, you can't see the other bones on there. There are 14 bones in this area of the wrist that there's a chance that any one of them, and definitely some of them, would have been broken if you were nailed through the wrist. And this is one reason why I don't believe Christ was crucified on a cross. Also, there's significant evidence to prove that the cross did not exist until nearly 300 years after Christ. The stake was a much better killing device as far as torture goes, though. The reason for this all has to do with breathing. We perform three different types of breathing, and each belongs to a different muscle. First, there's your diaphragm, which runs underneath your rib cage, separating the lung and heart cavity from your gut cavity. This muscle is a dual layer muscle, and when the lower muscle contracts, the lungs fill with air, and when the upper muscle contracts, the lungs void of air. If you're sitting and you hold your rib cage in and you breathe in just using your diaphragm, your stomach kind of pushes out, and then when you breathe in, your stomach sucks back in. This is breathing done with your diaphragm. This contributes for about 45% of all breathing. Second is the intercostal muscles, which are the muscles just between each rib. When these muscles relax, your chest expands outward and fills with air, and this also accounts for 45% of all breathing. Lastly is the supraclavicular muscle, which accounts for about 10% of all breathing. Not very much breathing is done with this muscle. This muscle attaches to your collarbones, goes over your shoulders, and attaches to your scapula. And when this muscle contracts, the rib cage lifts up and fills with air. Now, when hung on a cross, both the intercostals and the supraclavicular breathing muscles are impaired. Your arms are stretched out. These muscles are stretched out so that you cannot continually breathe in and out using these muscles. You cannot contract your chest muscles so that it pushes the air out. And also the way you're hanging, you're stretched out here. Your shoulders are pulled up so that you can't continually lift up and push back down with your supraclavicular muscle to breathe there. So the only type of breathing that you have is with your diaphragm. When you're hung on a stake, however, only the supraclavicular muscle is impaired. So you still have use of your intercostal muscles and your diaphragm muscles. So you would be able to breathe fairly regularly. On the cross, it is with both the intercostals and the supraclavicular breathing muscles being impaired, it is likely that suffocation will kill a person on a cross before bleeding, dehydration, or starvation occur. But on a stake, with only the supraclavicular muscles impaired, most likely the victim would bleed out or die from starvation or dehydration because of how long you hang on there. This is why the soldiers seem slightly surprised to find Christ dead so soon, and why they decided to make sure he was dead by piercing his side. Christ had only been hanging for about 3 to 6 hours, and when people usually hung for days, they probably wanted to make sure that he wasn't feigning death. I doubt that that was something that that probably occurred quite often, people not wanting to be on there, so they probably faked death and they ended up being stabbed to make sure that they were dead. But then that's why they pierced his side. Now, it just says that they pierced his side, but I don't think this is very specific. It is very likely that they pierced his heart. The left ventricle of the heart holds quite a bit of blood, enough to be able to tell when it came out that blood and water both came out. When the heart stops beating, blood stops flowing and settles toward gravity, pooling in the lowest area, which would have been his legs and feet. If the soldiers had just pierced the side of the stomach area, if they just pierced it in this area, most likely little or nothing would have come out. And if something did come out, it would have been too little to tell that the elements had separated. Meaning that if he was stabbed just in his side here, what came out would have been very little blood and plasma, which are the two elements that separate when a person dies. But if he had been stabbed in the left ventricle, enough blood would have been let out to tell that there was blood running down his side, which is formed elements, the blood cells and stuff, and the water coming out besides that. Well, I stood up here and told you all this stuff about his crucifixion, but why is that important? One reason, I believe, is to show Christ's complete obedience to his Father despite this great trial. Even when he knew he was going to die, he continued to obey. Why was this? One of the reasons was love, and I'm going to read from John 15, verse 13, which says, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends if you do whatsoever I command you." So, if we claim to be Christ's friends, it is now our duty to do what Christ has commanded us, to make sure that this truth that we hold remains pure and continues on down generations until Christ returns, that there may be a remnant left when Christ returns. Another reason is joy. Reading from Hebrews 12, verse 2. "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of God. It should also be our joy to be among the chosen who are graced with immortality," according to John 15, verse 11. Which reads, "These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you, and that your joy might be full." Finally, we see a great show of faith by Jesus. This faith was comparable to Abraham's, in that both had to believe that God would follow through with his promise and raise the chosen seed from the dead. We too are required to have faith in these last days. I think that you would have to be blinding yourself to the exciting events occurring these days to lack the faith that Christ's return is imminent. Also, you will notice that each one of these things, the love, joy, and faith, are all parts of the fruit of the Spirit. But my greatest reason for telling you all this, however, is to encourage you and strengthen you. This is a man who is about to be murdered, and he had the power to stop at any time. Even here, he was not selfish in any way. As he hung on the stake, he did not complain or cry or beg, but he turned to his mother and said in John 19, starting at verse 26, "When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by whom he loved, he said unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. And then he said to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour the disciple took her into his home." These two verses here have a bigger effect on the way I live my life personally than most verses in the Bible. Jesus is hanging on the stake. He is in horrible pain. He knows that he has the power to remove himself from the stake at any time. But what does he do instead? He preoccupies himself by thinking about the needs of others. This should be a huge influence on our lives. At any time we are faced with a choice or even a selfish thought, we should always make sure that we do what benefits our neighbor the most. And even in the face of great adversity or pain, we have no right to complain or only to continue serving God. Thank you. Thank you.